The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. And this is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. But let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.
Hi, this is John Schock. Welcome to The Beloved Community. The Beloved Community is heard live every second Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on KBOO in Portland, Oregon at 90.7, or live stream around the world at KBOO.fm. I also hold a weekly show called Progressive Spirit that is distributed through the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the public radio exchange. You can hear podcasts of my shows at ProgressiveSpirit.net. Normally, the program is live, but I'm in Montana this week celebrating my father's 100th birthday, so today's program is pre-recorded. My guest is Paul Ortiz. Dr. Ortiz is Associate Professor of History at the University of Florida, and he's the director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. He's written several books, including Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence in Florida, From Reconstruction to the Bloody Election of 1920, that received the 1990 Harry T. and Harriet V. Moore Book Prize. His latest book, and our topic of discussion today, is An African American and Latinx History of the United States. Welcome, Professor Ortiz, to the Beloved Community.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor to be able to join you. Thank you.
Your book is part of the Beacon Press Revisioning American History series, and the phrase revisionist history is often used, often in a derogatory or dismissive fashion toward perhaps the kind of historical work you do. It's often accused as being special interest history or whatnot. How do you see your work in regards to historical study and reflection? What is revisionist history?
Well, a person who reads an African American and Latinx history of the United States is going to see a lot of the same characters that one would see if you're reading something from, 1776 to present. I mean, you'll encounter Thomas Jefferson, John Quincy Adams, the old man John Adams, Thomas Paine and people like that. But you're going to encounter them in a different kind of way than you would in the mainstream history 101 college course. What I mean by this is that in this book, you're going to encounter them from the perspective of people in Mexico who reach out to the United States in 1815 and say, hey, let's form an anti-colonial movement here. You're going to encounter Alexander Hamilton from the perspective of the thousands of African Americans who evacuate with the British at the end of the American Revolution and say, we want to be free, and Alexander Hamilton is yelling and goes to the Continental Congress and says, we demand our property back, And so it's revisionist only in the sense that it's revisionist because we're trying to tell the story from black and brown perspectives, from people who were the backbone, the labor who built the nation, the people who fought for freedom. And so that's, I guess, where you could say it's revisionist. But again, many of the same time periods, many of the same individuals you would encounter in a normal history text, you're going to encounter them here, only you're going to see them from different perspectives.
For example, the American Revolution, you just alluded to it with Hamilton. You write in your book, quote, a revolution to safeguard slavery, property, and political power. And one of Thomas Jefferson's grievances against King George III was prompting our Negroes to rise in arms among us. I don't ever remember hearing that in history class about the American Revolution.
Right. And Jefferson grappled with that, John. We know now he wrote many different drafts of the Declaration of Independence, and he himself was torn over it. One of the misconceptions of U.S. history is that abolitionism, that is the anti-slavery movement, only really gets started by the 1840s, 1850s. You know, you have people like Frederick Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison, Sojourner Truth, so on and so forth. The reality is that the anti-slavery movement really begins in the 1600s. It's a century and a half before the American Revolution even starts. And Jefferson knows this. He's in dialogue, and he has read Thomas Paine's powerful anti-slavery tract. He understands that there have been major slave revolts that have already occurred throughout the transatlantic. And he also understands that the British have just decided a legal case. I talk about this in the book, which apparently means, which could mean, the death knell of slavery in the entire empire. And this is what Jefferson and the other so-called founding fathers are terrified of. They see the British Empire as beginning to move away from slavery. And if you looked at parliamentary debates in the 1760s and 1770s, that possibility is very real. The British began experimenting with other forms of labor. And more and more people in the core, that is in London, are saying, you know, maybe there's another more productive way of getting sugar, of getting coffee, getting indigo, so on and so forth, that doesn't involve slavery and doesn't get us into these moral dilemmas. So those discussions, pro versus anti-slavery, long antedate Jefferson. And I argue in the book, and this part of the book is based a lot both on primary but also secondary sources. The historical scholarship, John, is beginning to trend in that direction of saying that people in the United States, the so-called patriots, were very terrified of the possibility that the empire was going to abolish slavery. And this is one of the things that animates them to push for independence.
So really, the United States, or which becomes the United States, was really very late on the scene of abolishing slavery.
Oh, yes. The Spanish, the Portuguese, you know, really the first generation of slavery, indigenous slavery, you know, the Spanish enslaving indigenous people, once the reality comes back to, you know, the Spanish Empire, then people begin wondering. And on the one hand, Europeans love gold, right? We know that from, if you've had a chance to visit a European church, they love gold, they love silver. But the conditions that those things are mined under, the conditions that sugar cane is raised, I mean, these are killing people. And so from the outset, in all of those different European empires that you've outlined, whether it's the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the British, the French, so on and so forth, the first generation of their enslavement experiences, they begin debating amongst each other, well, we love the wealth, but the conditions, the appalling, the abysmal, the sinking of the human spirit, which slavery automatically engenders. See, this isn't something that John Chuck or Paul Ortiz just make up in 2018. This is something that people during Thomas Jefferson's own time were debating. Thomas Paine's first great tract is actually an anti-slavery tract, and it's being circulated around the time of the Revolution. And Paine is saying, people have a choice. It can be a real revolution, but it's got to be an anti-slavery revolution. And most importantly, the actions of enslaved African Americans in fighting, in some cases, for the Continental Army and George Washington, but in other cases, fighting for the British, because the British jump on this immediately and they say, we can actually raise an army by promising freedom to the people who fight for us. And this is something that eventually even the Americans have to bend on or have to will to, because there's a lot of deserters in the American Revolution. If you don't have black men in that Continental Army, the American Revolution doesn't turn out the way it turns out. That's one of the ironies of the Revolution. By the end of the Revolution, about one out of every six or seven soldiers in the Continental Army are men of color. They're black men.
Now, I'm getting back to how I remembered the history, was that the American Revolution was so far ahead of its time, you know, these great Enlightenment thinkers and whatnot. And the idea of slavery was just too much to handle at that first bump, but they'd come and take care of it later. I mean, that's kind of the the America as good history would say it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So how did that story become the dominant story?
I think it becomes a dominant story, John, in the same way that the story about, well, we didn't really need to fight the Civil War. Slavery would have ended of its own accord. That's a similar kind of fantasy. Now, you and I want to believe that fantasy because we want to believe the best in each other. Now, I want to say that, you know, I live in the best country on the face of the planet, but I can't say that if I live in a country where basically slavery was just getting stronger and stronger and stronger. Now, you're absolutely correct. In the 1770s and 1780s, you know, in the first decades after the end of the American Revolution, there were individuals, men of authority, primarily, who said, well, eventually slavery will die out, okay? The problem was that slavery was much too profitable to die out. And related to that is the fact that what we call now Wall Street is built on both land speculation in the Mississippi River Valley and places like Florida in the 1810s, 1820s, 1830s, the early insurance industry, you know, shipping trades, so many different sectors of the transatlantic economy rest upon the labor and the labor power and the value of enslaved people. That the notion that you can just, that slavery is somehow just going to die away, no one even takes that seriously anymore about a decade after the end of the American Revolution. That idea just, and the only people that float that idea are, frankly, wonderful idealists, but they're not connected to, you know, to these shipping firms. They're not connected to real estate. They're not connected to the cotton industry. They're not connected to indigo or sugar or dyestuffs. And the reality is that by the end by the dawning of the American Civil War, according to the latest statistics I've seen by economic historians, the value of African-American slaves in their persons alone was something approaching $13 trillion in today's money. Now ask yourself, $13 trillion, could you just do, you know, if you had a sector today that was worth that much, could you just do away with it overnight? And the answer would be no, right? Because, I mean, yeah, it was just too, the labor of the slaves was too valuable and was becoming even more valuable. And this is one of the reasons why, as time went on, that desire, if it had existed in the first place, of ending slavery of its own accord, so to speak, was just eclipsed by the reality of westward movement. And this is why the U.S., alone among the nations surrounding it, you know, while other nations are moving to abolish slavery, the British, the French, Native Americans, the Mexicans foremostly, the Haitians, ask yourself, why is the U.S. growing slavery? Why is it getting stronger? Why is the U.S. sending men to Central America in the 1850s to reimpose slavery? Why is the U.S. looking at Cuba and seriously hatching plans to purchase Cuban plantations? They're not talking about freeing people or emancipating people on those plantations. But again, it's the seduction of wealth, and slavery is the greatest wealth producing machine, up until that moment of history. It's really startling when you think about the value that slave laborers produced.
I'm speaking with Paul Ortiz. He's the author of An African American and Latinx History of the United States. And I'm wondering about, I'm keep going about the propaganda of this thing. For example, there's a place in there where you quote, the minority of slaveholding colonists depended on the vigilance of the majority who did not own slaves to police the system. And That's we certainly see that, I think, today in many sectors. How did that happen then? What was the vehicle to make the majority of people police the system against their own interests?
Well, this is one of the tragedies of American history, where oftentimes people will say today, well, you know, only a minority of people are slave owners. And that's absolutely true. But the reality is, to maintain that system, you had to maintain, you know, tens of thousands of open-air prisons, essentially, where people are constantly trying to escape these abysmal, horrific conditions. I mean, let's not mince words. A slave labor camp, which is what these were, we talk about plantations, was a horrific place to be. And there's no such thing as a good master. There's only slavery. It's just if you, the term good master right. would be as if you said, oh, you know, were there good Nazi concentration camp guards? That doesn't really matter. What matters is the reality of the concentration camps. And we have no, there's no document in case in American history or Brazilian history or Mexican history, any other history of any slave society I know, where a European person walks up to a plantation owner and says, hey, can I work in your plantation? Because you're going to take care of me, right? I mean, that never happens. No one would be idiotic enough to surrender their freedom, however nominal it may have been, to work on a slave plantation. These are abysmal places to work and to labor on. And this is one of the reasons why so much of early American history is a denial of that reality. Because again, no one, I mean, you know, you want to believe the best in your country. This is one of the reasons, John, why I start by saying, if we want to do American history right, we've got to deal with the concept of American innocence in American exceptionalism and just be open with it. Because if we're open with it, then we can also, it isn't just a bad history. It isn't just about oppression and slavery and Jim Crow. It's about resistance. It's about people who fight back. And that's one of the reasons why I love a character like a Thomas Paine. I love a character like even John Quincy Adams, who starts early on by sending Andrew Jackson into Florida to invade Spanish Florida. Not a good thing for human rights, right? But then 20 years later, he's like, oh, man, I screwed up. You know, I need to get myself on the right side of the equation here, you know. And so it's kind of a mix of stories, if you will. We're not changing any of the facts with the Revisioning American History series. We're just trying to look at them with new eyes.
Talk more about American exceptionalism. Define that for me, and show how that's different from an exceptionalism of, say, another country.
Yes. Well, it's a great question, John. So American exceptionalism is the idea that, you know, my country, right or wrong, but even more than that, in the case of the U.S., people would be familiar with, say, for example, the Pilgrims, you know, March of Progress, City on the Hill. U.S. is the last best hope on earth, the freest country that's ever existed. And again, it's a good fairy tale. It's something that can be very comforting during times of crisis. But interestingly enough, some of the major characters in my new book are the people who realize quickly that until we get Americans to understand that we need to be judged by our actions first, words are great, rhetoric is great, but look at our actions. And this is what people like Frederick Douglass do when he's asked to talk about how wonderful the North is during the Civil War. He flips the script and he says, well, no, Northerners are just as guilty for the oncoming of the Civil War because we did this. You know, we placated the Southern slave power. We waged war on Mexico. We invaded Mexico to both extend slavery, but then to try to stop Mexico from taking slaves and granting them freedom. And I guess it's also, you know, having to think about American exceptionalism, it's the question of innocence. Americans are trained that we don't do anything wrong. And so we invade a country, you know, we go into Libya, we take out the leadership, and then two or three years later, we realize Libya has become a hotbed for ISIS terrorism, and the slave trade has reemerged. And so you'll hear commentators say things like, well, we took out the government with the best of intentions. Well, no, we didn't. We said the same thing when we invaded Vietnam, and then we ended up, you know, killing over a million people. We finished that war by saying we had the best of intentions. Well, no, we didn't. The reality is that we're no better or no worse than any other country on the face of the planet. And the other part of your question, John, is that if you go to a country like the Dominican Republic or to Trinidad, smaller countries, those are countries where people are much more open to the notion that, hey, I'm proud of my country, but I've never heard anyone tell me that Trinidad is the freest country on the face of the planet. I've never had anyone tell me that the Dominican Republic is the birthplace of freedom in the Americas, although people were, the Europeans were in the Dominican Republic long before they went to the United States. So it's that, in part because the U.S. is so large, it adapts this idea of itself as being beyond judgment. And this is something that the abolitionists, that people in the civil rights movement, people like Dr. King, always went straight for the notion of innocence, to say that if you're always innocent, you can't be held responsible for anything. That's the problem of American foreign policy writ large.
American exceptionalism then is pretty much a racist category, right? I mean, it's mostly white people who've grabbed onto that, going all the way back to an identity with the Pilgrims and Puritans. Is that close?
It's this idea. I mean, yeah, let's test this as a hypothesis. So let's look at Mexico. In chapter 2 of my book, I talk about the freedom struggle in Mexico. I mean, essentially, the Mexican War of Independence is a war against the oppression of indigenous people, as they've been oppressed by the Spanish for centuries. And it's a war against slavery. And the Mexicans, actually, during the War of Independence, try to outreach to the United States on several occasions and say, let's form a hemispheric-wide coalition, an anti-colonial coalition. You all fought an anti-colonial war against the British. You know what we're doing against the Spanish. Let's get together. Let's join forces. Americans, even by that early point in U.S. history, are like, we don't want to have anything to do with you brown-skinned people. You know, Mexican people can't be civilized the way that Anglo people have. I mean, you have a different civilization than we do. Our civilization, our Anglo-Saxon traditions are superior to the Latin traditions. So yes, very early on, race and racism become part of American exceptionalism. And in my book, I looked at correspondence between John Adams, his kids, you know, John Quincy Adams, first and foremost, obviously, but where they're talking to each other about, and they're testing these ideas out, John, and at one point, it looks as if the younger generation in the Adams family is beginning to understand, hey, look at all these insurgencies happening in South America. And then, John Adams Sr. is saying, yeah, but these aren't real, these aren't real revolutions like our revolution. They're more like slave insurgencies. And we want to avoid that. And so they come up with the term South American liberty, which I talk about. And what does South American liberty mean? It means it's not as good. It's not as advanced, as so-called American liberty. So yes, very much early on, these notions of race and racism, especially the fact that you have African ancestry people, Native ancestry people fighting for their freedom, in some cases becoming generals of liberation armies, serving with Simon Bolivar a bit later in the century, and the so-called founding fathers and their sons look askance. They're terrified. They don't want South American liberty. They don't want men of color, women of color leading anything. They want them working on the plantations.
Your book is called An African American and Latinx History of the United States, making that connection. For example, Mexico abolishing slavery in 1829, at the same time the United States is expanding slavery. And there are connections that you're making that oftentimes we don't get of coalitions between Latin American people and African American or Native American people. Can you talk more about that?
Yes. Even before the Mexican War of Independence concluded successfully, African Americans were beginning to get the word that if we can make it, African American slaves get the word that if we can make it to Mexico, we can find sanctuary. And this becomes such a powerful movement. I ask my classes, I say, hey, if I use the term Underground Railroad, what country do you associate the Underground Railroad with? And 99.9% of the time, people are like Canada. People escaped to freedom to Canada. And I say, yes, that's true. There were a lot of people who were able to do that. But if you're an enslaved person in southern Louisiana or western Florida, or the Mississippi Delta, how much of a trek is it to Canada versus Mexico? And then you see the lights go off in people's eyes, John, and they begin thinking. And then I show them documents where U.S. congressmen are infuriated, and they're going to the U.S. Congress and saying, you know, we demand our government file lawsuits against the government of Mexico for making us lose our property. And this is even before there is such a thing as the government of Mexico, because Mexico is still fighting the Spanish. And so this is one example of kind of a subaltern alliance from below, if you will. I mean, no one gets up and publishes a manifesto saying, you know, slaves come to Mexico to be free. It's just that that's what's happening. Another really powerful point that I found in the research of this, and I have to say the research was really incredibly fun. It was amazing to go back to look at an event like Reconstruction. I had read thousands of pages and scores of books on Reconstruction. And when I went back and I started doing primary research and I uncovered what I ended up calling the Cuban Solidarity Movement, I was appalled, man. I was like, my God, I have a PhD in history, and I don't even understand what Reconstruction is. So let me lay it out for you. So the moment that African Americans gain their freedom, the moment the Civil War ends, the key abolitionists, and at first I didn't know what to make of this, the key abolitionists, people like Frederick Douglass, people like Henry Highland Garnett, you know, people like William Scottrun and others say, our struggle for slavery is not over. Let's not celebrate too soon. So on the one hand, you have William Lloyd Garrison, you know, the leading abolitionist in the country, a white man, an incredible heroic person, who says, okay, 1865, end of the Civil War, it's time to dismantle our anti-slavery societies. And that's a pretty big, you know, it's a pretty big order, you know. And Frederick Douglass and Henry Highland Garnett are like, wait a minute now. We may have abolished slavery in the U.S., although that's not clear, it's really happened yet. But most importantly, what about Cuba? What about Brazil? What about even Russia? Do we really think that the serfs have been emancipated? And so right away, there's an attempt to keep these anti-slavery organizations together by really the most advanced or radical black abolitionists. And they create an organization, a number of organizations, exactly, in fact, because what happens after the end of the American Civil War is almost, you know, almost right afterwards, people in Cuba rise up against Spain, and they begin demanding their independence, and they put armies in the field. And at a certain point, the independence struggle in Cuba becomes also an anti-slavery struggle. You have a lot of leaders of that movement against the Spanish are people of color, slaves or former slaves. And so they network with African Americans in the United States and say, we need y'all's help. We don't want the United States to invade Cuba. All we want the United States to do is to grant us belligerency status, which will enable us to allow arms and weaponry to come in without them being stopped by the British or the Americans. We need arms and ammunition. We need your support. We need your moral support. You know, we don't need your troops, because we can fight the war and win it by ourselves. And so it creates what I call the Cuban Solidarity Movement, this incredible alliance between African Americans who just have won their freedom with the Cuban Liberation Movement in the 1860s through the 1880s. And again, John, this was humbling for me, because I realized at a certain point, how could I have missed? This is a national movement. They put together a petition campaign to lean on to present to Ulysses S. Grant. And they collected hundreds of thousands of petition signatures. I'm like, this is an astonishing achievement. You know, they didn't even have the internet, man. And somehow, and I found records all the way from black conventions in Santa Cruz, California, to New York, to Gainesville, Florida, you know, to Silver City, Nevada. The minutes of these meetings where African Americans would talk about, we need to create a government where we're not getting lynched. We need to create a society where we have equality in education, and we need to demonstrate our continued support to our brothers and sisters in the Cuban struggle. And I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, wow, I mean, you talk about a moment where you're under stress, and you still find the wherewithal to understand that your freedom is wrapped up in my freedom. And if you're unfree, then I'm unfree as well. And so that was really, really amazing to find out.
I'm speaking with Paul Ortiz, and we're discussing his book, An African American and Latinx History of the United States. More to come. I'm John Schuck, and this is The Beloved Community. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen, and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Paul Ortiz, author of An African American and Latinx History of the United States. This is The Beloved Community. Now, you talked about they didn't have the internet, and I want to go there for a second in terms of the press, mainstream press, whatever that might have been back then, and perhaps alternative press back then. I mean, that's still the case. I mean, these things are happening. They're just not getting in the news.
Yeah. The work you're doing now, John, I mean, and you're the alternative press, right? You're the foundation stone of our ability to continue telling the truth. What you had back in, let's go forward to the 1920s. So during the 1920s, or even the 1910s for that matter, the U.S. is invading Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Honduras. We're sending people, boots on the ground, and overturning governments. And if you read the New York Times about these invasions, what you'll read there is of the United States glowing reports, the U.S. uplifting the savage Central American, the U.S. bringing women's rights, you know, and emancipation and all these things. But when you read the newspapers written by people like Spanish language newspapers or black newspapers, and this is the amazing thing, the black press, or what used to be called the Negro press, in some ways was at its peak in the 1920s and 1930s. And that's the place that I went, and I stumbled on this. I had an experience being a former Special Forces soldier in Central America to know a lot of the names of the earlier rebels against U.S. authority, people like Augusto Sandino. Now, if you read the New York Times and get their characterization of Sandino in the 1920s, they vilified him. The New York Times said the man is a bandit, he's a terrorist, he's a villain. But if you read the Norfolk Journal and Guide or the Pittsburgh Courier, black newspapers, they said Sandino is fighting for his people's freedom. And you would do the same if you were in his shoes. And this is what I mean by kind of this alternative media back then, the black press writing things like, you know, when the U.S. finally subdues Sandino and finally consolidates its control in Nicaragua, you have the black press basically saying, almost all of the black newspapers, not all of them, but almost all of them saying, the U.S. victory is something to be ashamed of. It's not something to gloat about. It's a catastrophe for those people, for the people that have to endure it. Now, can you imagine someone in a newspaper saying that about Afghanistan today? The U.S. has been in Afghanistan for how many years? 16, 17?
Yeah, longest war going, isn't it?
Exactly. Can you imagine the New York Times coming out and saying, we are so sorry for encouraging the U.S. to invade this country, and we're sorry for year after year endorsing this occupation. It will.
I can't imagine it, but they should do it.
Yeah, I hope you and I live long enough to see that day, John. But I kind of doubt it. I'm not banking on it. But again, this vibrancy. I mean, today we talk about, you know, alternative media and the wonderful blogs and podcasts and things like that. But in some ways, I think that in the early, you know, late, I don't want to romanticize this, but, you know, again, look at something like the Spanish language press in the 1850s in California. And so if I tell my students, if you want to study Manifest Destiny, do so. But here's some great sources. Read a California-based newspaper. I mean, read a Los Angeles newspaper. A lot of them have been translated from Spanish to English now. And read the response of a Mexican American editor to the U.S. march across the continent, and then factor that into what you've read about Manifest Destiny in your textbook. And I guarantee you, you're going to get a different perspective. You know, you're going to get a perspective which is going to is really going to, you know, shake up your understanding about the country you live in.
So talk about manifest destiny. Is that related to what you call racial capitalism?
It is, and I think I made the argument in the book, and you know, I'm really excited to get critiques and thoughts. I've done almost 40 book events since the book has come out after New Year, and this is one case where people we had great dialogues. My argument in the book is that Manifest Destiny is essentially a way for the U.S. to try to consolidate control of North America before all of these freedom struggles can have any kind of impact in the U.S. proper. The U.S. wants to keep Canada at bay. It wants to keep Mexico at bay. Once the British abolish slavery in the 1830s, the British become an enemy. You know, the French are on their way as well. And so Manifest Destiny is like a race to get to the West, not to bring freedom, but to subjugate and dispossess Native American people, and then to make sure to consolidate the borders against all of these other nations, Mexico and the others, who have abolished slavery. So in other words, protecting property, you know, protecting the rule of law insofar as it has to do with maintaining property relations. Racial capitalism is simply a reminder that from its inception, capitalism has always depended upon racial exploitation, racial oppression, creating the racialized other so that you can pay black or brown people no wages at all, or you can pay them less to do the same kind of work you would pay a white worker. And so capital creates racial differences wherever it goes. I mean, there's no exceptions that I can think of right off the bat. But again, trying to get people to see, and it's funny, in my classes, my labor history classes, some of my students the first day of class will say, well, capitalism didn't start until after 1865. And I'll say, well, what makes you say that? Well, it couldn't exist during slavery because capitalism is all about freedom. And I'm like, okay, let's interrogate that. What elements do you connect to capitalism? Well, you know, commodities, exchange, property values, so on and so forth. These all existed during slavery. Human beings were traded as commodities. That's capitalism.
Right. My guest is Paul Ortiz. He's an author. He's the author of An African American and Latinx History of the United States. I want to turn to your story a little bit. You served in the military. You went down into Central America. You really had a lot of changes that went through you as you did this service. Can you talk a little bit about your service in the military? Yeah. and what you experienced?
John, when I went to Central America, I was an American exceptionalist, because I didn't know any better. My country was the freest country on earth. We were God's gift to the world. You know, we had some special kind of mission. And from the time I set foot in Central America, that view was challenged big time. Because number one, I'm working in different cultures. I travel all across the region, sometimes with other people, sometimes by myself. And I realized, wow, you know, people have tremendous amounts of philosophical and political sophistication down here. And they have very different opinions about the United States than I had when I was growing up. Now, I have to be honest with you, I wasn't able to process all this information at one time. And it took me many years to figure out what was so wrong about what we were doing in Central America. I mean, some of it was obvious, you know, not a good idea to train teenagers how to shoot straight. And that's part of what I was doing. I grew up in a gun culture. I could shoot pretty well. And so part of what I was doing was working in teams, you know, training soldiers and civil guards how to be better at what they were doing. And by the time I left the region, I only began to really question that, you know, towards the very end. I mean, because I was too immersed in this mission and I didn't have people around me. It wasn't like the 60s, you know, that there wasn't a big anti-war movement. But when I got home, I picked up a book that I'm sure you're familiar with, called People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. Mm-hmm. And the reason this book resonated with me, and a veteran put this in my hand. He said, I want you to read this book, because when I got back home, I was pissed off. I mean, I had seen a lot. I had taken it apart a lot. I had seen people killed. And when I got back home in the U.S. in 86, 87, people would say, oh, thank you for fighting communism. And I was like, what in the hell are you talking about? Do you really know what I was doing there? And they'd say, oh, yeah, you were keeping America safe for democracy. I'm like, in Honduras, in Colombia, in Venezuela, are you kidding me? The other thing they would say, John, is they'd say, Paul, why are all these Hondurans or Colombians or Central Americans living now in Los Angeles or Seattle or, you know, or Miami even? And I would say, you don't know. I said, it's your government's policies, our government's policies in Central America that have turned their nations into howling wilderness. And so you can't raise a family in a war zone. You have to leave, you know, and that's why it's what Juan Gonzalez refers to as harvest of empire, right? All of these people have to move to L.A. and other parts in the U.S., and then U.S. Americans can play the innocence card again. Oh, we didn't have anything to do with that. It just accidentally occurs, you know. And so, yeah, having those experiences were very visceral to me, having people tell me I didn't know what I had been doing in Central America. I mean, I remember people I grew up with, John, I went to high school with, and I would try to explain to them what was really going on. We'd be at parties. They would get up and move to the other side of the room. They wanted to defend at all costs their innocence, our innocence. You know, Paul, we couldn't really be doing, we couldn't be arming people who are bombing hospitals. That's just not who Americans are. This is not what we do. I'm like, hey, this is what we do. Okay. I was there. I saw some of this. It's actually on the news now. And if you, because by the time I got back, what was one of the main stories? The trial of Oliver North.
Mm-hmm.
And this was another really terrible episode in American history where we had the chance to come clean as a nation and to say, let's take ownership of what we have done, what we have inflicted on the people of Central America. And instead, all the attention gets put on this one Marine colonel, a very mediocre individual, I should say. And instead of looking at ourselves in the mirror, we decided to place, we either turn North into a criminal or into a hero when we should have been doing neither.
This history work and how crucial it is to be able to see current events with a clearer picture. Do you now, when you read any newspaper or any alternative media or whatever, what lens you look at and say, for example, whatever is happening in Syria, say, or ongoing in Iraq or the Middle East or whatever, do you find this work of history, does it continue? I mean, American exceptionalism is what I'm getting at. American exceptionalism and simply the propaganda and the quest for greed.
Yes. Well, again, I would say judge us by our actions. Let's sit down and look at what we've been doing in Central America, in Africa, in Syria, wherever you want to talk about. And then let's judge our allies. You know, let's judge Israel. Let's judge the United Kingdom by the same criteria instead of picking a different criteria for our actions. And, John, that's what we've done on too often, too many occasions. So, you know, we'll criticize other nations for invading other nations. And we're happy to criticize other nations for violating the sovereignty of other nations. It's just that we reserve the right to violate any nation's sovereignty. And that's something that I think we need to begin really interrogating. Is this the right way of doing things? Because clearly it is not working. I think history becomes even more important. And let's look at what happened in the 2016 election. Donald Trump won the presidency in part by calling and invoking history, you know, make America great again. And so many people were seduced by that, John, because they don't understand U.S. American history. They don't understand the symbolism of this man going and visiting the tomb of Andrew Jackson. And what that meant for Native American people, what that meant for African Americans, because the standard American is ignorant of that history, and they don't know who Andrew Jackson was. But I'm going to tell you right now, I do research with the Poarch Creek Nation in Alabama. And when Trump went to go visit the tomb of Andrew Jackson, people in the Creek Nation understood exactly what he was doing. Okay, so Make America Great Again is Make America White Supremacist Again. Make America Great Again is to honor and celebrate the genocide, you know, the slavery that people like Jackson were responsible for enlarging and enforcing. And yes, this means that history is more important than ever, because I tell you that Trump knows that part of the history. He knows, I mean, why didn't he go and visit Abraham Lincoln's tomb? You know, why was it Andrew Jackson? You know, it could have been Warren Harding. You know, why was it Andrew Jackson? And, you know, it's kind of a dog whistle, if you will.
Yeah, and why did Trump single out Haiti as one of the, what did he say, whole countries? Is there a connection between Donald Trump's statement and Haiti's revolution?
Yes. This is why Haiti and Mexico are the first two chapters of my new book on U.S. history, John. And it gets even better than that. It's that very often, for a person like Donald Trump or a person like John Quincy, you know, the old John Quincy Adams, it isn't just Haiti. It's Haiti and Mexico. You often see them pairing those two nations. Why is it? Well, number one, it's that the United States typically has been afraid of Haiti. They've been typically afraid of Mexico, because throughout most of the history, ideas of freedom and liberty have thrived in places like Haiti and Mexico. At the same point, they've been imprisoned in the United States. What I mean by this is that even after the end of World War II, the Haitians are coming to international meetings, and the Mexicans are coming to international meetings saying, if you want to avoid another world war, what we have to do is we have to create an idea of equality between nations and equality within nations. Now, you can imagine how the U.S. responds to such an idea in 1945. They're not very happy about it. They're like, go away with these ideas. You know, we want to use our military to enforce, you know, domestic tranquility. And it's that Haiti, for so many generations, not just years, not just decades, but generations, was the place that inspired African-American slave revolts. It was the place that inspired people like José Martí, Antonio Maceo, Simón Bolívar, the list goes on and on. In other words, Haiti was seen as a beacon of liberty. Mexico was seen as a place of sanctuary for enslaved people. The U.S. does not like those things. It gets into a habit of vilifying those two nations, because those two nations represent a threat to the United States. And even during the time of the Mexican Revolution, my family left Mexico during the revolution the same year that the U.S. Marines invaded Tampico around the great oil fields. The fear was that Mexico was going to nationalize the oil industry and take land redistribution too far in the favor of the peasants and begin to take land away from American corporations. And for all these reasons and many more, the U.S. has frequently vilified Haiti and Mexico. And it's just become part of the American DNA. And you just want to say, stop, you know, stop doing that. I mean, we owe so much to the Haitians and to the Mexicans for our basic ideas of freedom, of social democracy, of liberty. Let's stop vilifying them. Let's kind of change the soundtrack, if you will.
I'm going to ask one more negative question and then a positive one. The negative one is this one in regards to, you mentioned 1945, and I'm thinking of kind of this, that their era of history between then and today, especially with the intelligence agencies of the United States and their role in all of this. You know, the CIA, well, let's say Martin Luther King's assassination or whatever, these kinds of things. Do you find a connection? Are these intelligence agencies used to continue these American exceptionalism and this racial divide?
That's a great question, John. Well, one of the ways that intelligence agencies are used, and I don't talk about this as much in the book, there's a wonderful literature about this, but if you look at the Universal Negro Improvement Association, or what some people call Garvey, you know, at the time of World War I in the 1920s, this was an internationalist organization. This was an anti-colonial organization. And you had these UNIA chapters, not just in the U.S. You had them in Cuba. You had them in Europe. You had them in Africa and Asia. And this is one of the first examples of these. I mean, the organization that becomes the FBI cuts its teeth, essentially, on spying on and trying to undermine the Universal Negro Improvement Association. It sees UNIA. At the same time, it sees like the Wobblies, the industrial workers of the world, as threats. Why? Both the IWW and UNIA have internationalist conceptions of freedom. They're very much opposed to a notion of American exceptionalism. They're into the idea of, you know, an injury to one is an injury to all. it's hard for Americans to accept this. But the reason that Martin Luther King Jr. becomes public enemy number one is very simple. The idea that an injury to one is an injury to all. You know, what the Wobblies were teaching in the 1910s, what Dr. King was teaching in the 1950s, is the most dangerous idea of all. Because it takes the U.S. and it puts us down on the same level as Mexico, as France, as Haiti. And it says we're part of a real community of nations. And you can't lift us up above any of those other nations. Again, you know, my freedom is connected to the freedom or unfreedom of the poorest person in Haiti or that villager in Vietnam that Dr. King was trying to get people to connect to a poor ghetto resident in Watts Willowbrook in Los Angeles in 1964, right? And it's those basic ideas of human solidarity that I believe are inherent in all of us that these intelligence agencies are trying to stamp out. J. Edgar Hoover hates the idea of solidarity. He hates mainstream trade unions, much less a black man who's going to be talking about what he has in common with a Vietnamese villager, a poor white Appalachian coal miner, a Chicano in California, you know, a white radical in New York. I mean, this is one of the things that we have to come to grips with is that we have intelligence agencies designed to suppress the best instincts of human nature. And what are we going to do about that?
My last question, and I'm going to give you the last word here. And I'm quoting near the end. You write, it's an incontestable fact that the United States advances the most when its most oppressed people achieve power and control over their lives. And that's really what I hear when I read is the real hopeful and powerful note in your book. Can you close with that? Talk a little bit about the positive aspects of how you see this happening.
Yeah. Well, for black and brown history, it's very simple. I mean, it's not, you know, it doesn't take a $1 million grant. It doesn't take a miracle or, you know, I'll give you two quick examples. One is my wife and I worked on this struggle. I talk a little bit about the book with the United Farm Workers, the Chateau Ste. Michel wine boycott. Workers fought for 8 years for a union contract. A major corporation, U.S. Tobacco, arrayed against them. The government arrayed against them. The police arrayed against them. They finally persevered. They won a union contract in 1995. That contract is still in force. Now you've had generations of young Mexican-American kids with the resources to go to college. You have families that have pensions, that have living wages. They're farm workers, but they can actually put a house, you know, they can put a roof over their heads. To me, that's tremendous hope. It may seem mundane, but for our histories in this country, you can't take economic security for granted. I mean, the other example is, I was just thinking about this as we were talking, I had the incredible privilege of interviewing sanitation workers who had organized in the 1968 Memphis sanitation workers strike. But I interviewed them years after the strike, you know, and after Dr. King, of course, was assassinated in the middle of that strike. And to talk with them, you know, and this put tears in my eyes. And I was just starting out as a grad student. I mean, these were men and women who sacrificed everything and who really understood that the price of victory in the case was actually the loss of Dr. King. He was killed, you know, advocating for poor people, for striking workers. But to see them talk about the difference that the strike had made in their lives. They weren't asking to become rich as sanitation workers. They were just asking for a shot, you know, to be able to help, you know, raise their kids with a certain level of dignity, to buy a small house, to be in a union together, you know, a collaborative effort. And then the last thing I'll mention is the Central American Solidarity Movement. And the readers will see in my book, I make reference to that. That was the movement that really educated me, John. And when I got back to the U.S. and talking to brothers and sisters in Veterans for Peace themselves, many of them Korean and Vietnam War veterans, explaining to me why they were fighting for peace. And actually, by the way, some of them in the same area that I was in when I was in Special Forces, I didn't know it. They were down there advocating for peace. But this notion that you could create a hemispheric-wide freedom movement, solidarity movement, And then we had the sanctuary movement, as you know, in the 80s, where I began working with people to help provide sanctuary to people who were refugees from Central America, people who I had helped create the refugee crisis, right, is my work with the United States military. So, yeah, I find a lot of hope in history.
Paul Ortiz, my guest, his book is an incredible and important read, An African American and Latinx History of the United States. Professor Ortiz, thank you so much for this and for being with me today.
Thank you, John. Wonderful program. Again, a great honor to be able to talk with you. Thank you for the great work you're doing.
You've been listening to The Beloved Community every second Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. Find podcasts of all my shows at progressivespirit.net or go to the KBOO.fm website, KBOO.fm/beloved community. I'm John Schuck. Be well.